fall off a pall mall in the shadows of a Friday night bleacher. One Converse chuck up against the pole. She was happy where no one could reach her. She kinda dug the way I wore my hair and the T-tops on my old Trans Am. I thought about her when I chose what to wear, cause she likes ripped jeans and Ray-Bans. Outside, where the wild things run. Outside, we were children of the sun. Outside, where only we knew where. We got what we wanted, didn't know we needed. Didn't care about the lines we cheated. Outside, never let on about her lightning eyes, but she never wanted.
Your Tanner Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram time
is 6 o'clock.
FM 104.9 WSKV.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us tonight on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV for our new and exciting Pick Me a Story series, where you'll embark on a journey through the pages of different stories read aloud by featured librarians from the Powell County Public Library. You can tune in live right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, listen online or on demand at listenlikealocal.com with our free mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcast. My name is Kelly Ward, and I am the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library. I'll be reading all kinds of different books to you from different genres, like sci-fi and fantasy, westerns, mysteries, and more. Be healthy at home with the whole family and enjoy the storytelling service provided by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and the Powell County Public Library. Pick Me a Story will be every Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on your hometown station, and we're so excited you can join us tonight. Let's get started. For tonight's show, we'll be reading science fiction short stories by the one and only literary mastermind, Ray Bradbury. You might remember a month or two ago when we read the short story, There Will Come Soft Rains, by Ray Bradbury, which was a tale about a smart house left standing in a world destroyed by nuclear fallout. That story, along with the stories I've picked out tonight, exemplifies Bradbury's simple yet startling style, in which the extraordinary feel like commonplace. Our first story of the night is a story from Ray Bradbury's book titled The Illustrated Man. I highly recommend reading the whole book, but for tonight, I'll be sharing with you a few of the short stories within the book. This first story is titled The Rocket Man. We are introduced to a young boy and his mother, who seem to live their lives around the comings and goings of the boy's father, who is a rocket man who spends most of the year traveling to different planets in space. But the father's absence from Earth has taken a toll on his son and wife, and quite possibly even on himself. This is an interesting story about what it means to miss someone or something, or even a dream or a different life. This is The Rocket Man by Ray Bradbury. I hope you enjoy it. The electrical fireflies were hovering above Mother's dark hair to light her path. She stood in her bedroom door, looking out at me as I passed in the silent hall. "You will help me keep him here this time, won't you?" she asked. "I guess so," I said. "Please." The fireflies cast moving bits of light on her white face. "This time, he mustn't go away again." "All right," I said, after standing there a moment. "But it won't do any good. It's no use." She went away, and the fireflies, on their electric circuits, fluttered after her like an errant constellation, showing her how to walk in darkness. I heard her say, faintly, "We've got to try, anyway." Other fireflies followed me to my room. When the weight of my body cut a circuit in the bed, the fireflies winked out. It was midnight, and my mother and I waited, our rooms separated by darkness and bed. The bed began to rock me and sing to me. I touched a switch. The singing and rocking stopped. I didn't want to sleep. I didn't want to sleep at all. This night was no different from a thousand others in our time. We would wake nights and feel the cool air turn hot, feel the fire and the wind, or see the walls burned a bright color for an instant. And then we knew his rocket was over our house. His rocket and the oak tree swaying from the concussion. And I would lie there, eyes wide, panting, and mother in her room. Her voice would come to me over the interroom radio. "Did you feel it?" And I would answer, "That was him, all right." That was my father's ship passing over our town, a small town where space rockets never came, and we would lie awake for the next 2 hours, thinking. Now Dad's landed in Springfield. Now he's on the tarmac. Now he is signing the papers. Now he's in the helicopter. Now he's over the river. Now the hills. Now he's settling the helicopter in at the little airport at Green Village here. And the night would be half over when, in our separate, cool beds, Mother and I would be listening, listening. Now he's walking down Bell Street. He always walks, never takes a cab. Now across the park. Now turning the corner of Oakhurst. And now... I lifted my head from my pillow. Far down the street, coming closer and closer, smartly, quickly, briskly, footsteps. Now turning in at our house, up the porch steps. And we were both smiling in the cool darkness, Mom and I, when we heard the front door open in recognition, speak a quiet word of welcome, and shut downstairs. 3 hours later, I turned the brass knob to their room quietly, holding my breath, balancing in a darkness as big as the space between the planets, my hand out to reach the small, black case at the foot of my parents' sleeping bed. Taking it, I ran silently to my room, thinking, "He won't tell me. He doesn't want me to know." And from the opened case spilled his black uniform, like a black nebula, stars glittering here or there, distantly, in the material. I kneaded the dark stuff in my warm hands. I smelled the planet Mars, an iron smell, and the planet Venus, a green ivy smell, and the planet Mercury, a scent of sulfur and fire. And I could smell the Milky Moon and the hardness of stars. I pushed the uniform into a centrifuge machine I'd built in my 9th grade shop that year, set it whirling. Soon, a fine powder precipitated into a retort. This I slid under a microscope. And while my parents slept unaware, and while our house was asleep, all the automatic bakers and servers and robot cleaners in electric slumber, I stared down upon brilliant motes of meteor dust, comet tail, and loam from far Jupiter, glistening like worlds themselves, which drew me down the tube a billion miles into space at terrific accelerations. At dawn, exhausted with my journey and fearful of discovery, I returned the boxed uniform to their sleeping room. Then I slept, only to waken at the sound of the horn of the dry cleaning car, which stopped in the yard below. They took the black uniform box with them. It's good I didn't wait, I thought, for the uniform would be back in an hour, clean of all its destiny and travel. I slept again, with the little vial of magical dust in my pajama pocket, over my beating heart. When I came downstairs, there was Dad at the breakfast table, biting into his toast. "Sleep good, Doug?" he said, as if he had been here all the time, and hadn't been gone for 3 months. "All right," I said. "Toast?" He pressed a button, and the breakfast table made me 4 pieces, golden brown. I remember my father that afternoon, digging and digging in the garden, like an animal after something, it seemed. There he was, with his long, dark arms, moving swiftly, planting, tamping, fixing, cutting, pruning, his dark face always down to the soil, his eyes always down to what he was doing, never up to the sky, never looking at me or mother, even, unless we knelt with him to feel the earth soak up through the overalls at our knees, to put our hands into the black dirt and not look at the bright, crazy sky. Then he would glance to either side, to mother or me, and give us a gentle wink, and go on, bent down, face down, the sky staring at his back. That night, we sat on the mechanical porch swing, which swung us and blew a wind upon us and sang to us. It was summer, and moonlight, and we had lemonade to drink, and we held the cold glasses in our hands, and Dad read the stereo newspapers inserted into the special hat you put on your head, and which turned the microscopic page in front of the magnifying lens if you blinked 3 times in succession. Dad smoked cigarettes and told me about how it was when he was a boy in the year 1997. After a while, he said, as he had always said, "Why aren't you out playing kick the can, Doug?" I didn't say anything, but Mom said, "He does, on nights when you're not here." Dad looked at me, and then, for the first time that day, at the sky. Mother always watched him when he glanced at the stars. The first day and night when he got home, he wouldn't look at the sky much. I thought about him gardening, and gardening so furiously, his face almost driven into the earth. But the second night, he looked at the stars a little more. Mother wasn't afraid of the sky and the day so much, but it was the night stars that she wanted to turn off. And sometimes I could almost see her reaching for a switch in her mind, but never finding it. And by the third night, maybe Dad'd be out here on the porch until way after we were all ready for bed. And then I'd hear Mom call him in, almost like she called me from the street at times. And then I would hear Dad fitting the electric eye door lock in place, with a sigh. And the next morning at breakfast, I'd glance down and see his little black case near his feet, as he buttered his toast, and Mother slept late. "Well, be seeing you, Doug," he'd say, and we'd shake hands. "In about 3 months?" "Right." And he'd walk away down the street, not taking a helicopter or beetle or bus, just walking with his uniform hidden in his small underarm case. He didn't want anyone to think he was vain about being a rocket man. Mother would come out to eat breakfast, one piece of dry toast, about an hour later. But now, it was tonight, the first night, the good night, and he wasn't looking at the stars much at all. "Let's go to the television carnival," I said. "Fine," said Dad. Mother smiled at me. And we rushed off to town in a helicopter and took Dad through 1,000 exhibits to keep his face and head down with us and not looking anywhere else. And as we laughed at the funny things and looked serious at the serious ones, I thought, my father goes to Saturn and Neptune and Pluto, but he never brings me presents. Other boys whose fathers go into space bring back bits of ore from Callisto and hunks of black meteor or blue sand. But I have to get my own collection, trading from other boys, the Martian rocks and Mercurian sands which filled my room, but about which Dad would never comment. On occasion, I remembered, he brought something for Mother. He planted some Martian sunflowers once in our yard, but after he was gone a month and the sunflowers grew large, Mom ran out one day and cut them all down. Without thinking, as we paused at one of the three-dimensional exhibits, I asked Dad the question I always asked. "What's it like out in space?" Mother shot me a frightened glance. It was too late. Dad stood there for a full half minute, trying to find an answer. Then he shrugged. "It's the best thing in a lifetime of best things." Then he caught himself. "Oh, it's really nothing at all. Routine. You wouldn't like it." He looked at me apprehensively. "But you always go back." "Habit." "Where are you going next?" "I haven't decided yet. I'll think it over." He always thought it over. In those days, rocket pilots were rare, and he could pick and choose work when he liked. on the third night of his homecoming, you could see him picking and choosing among the stars. "Come on," said Mother. "Let's go home." It was still early when we got home. I wanted Dad to put on his uniform. I shouldn't have asked. It always made Mother unhappy. But I could not help myself. I kept at him, though he had always refused. I had never seen him in it, and at last he said, "Oh, all right." We waited in the parlor while he went upstairs and the air flew. Mother looked at me dully, as if she couldn't believe that her own son could do this to her. I glanced away. "I'm sorry," I said. "You're not helping at all," she said. "At all." There was a whisper in the air flue a moment later. "Here I am," said Dad, quietly. We looked at him in his uniform. It was glossy black with silver buttons and silver rims to the heels of the black boots, and it looked as if someone had cut the arms and legs and body from a dark nebula, with little faint stars glowing through it. It fit as close as a glove fits to a slender, long hand, and it smelled like cool air and metal and space. It smelled of fire and time. Father stood, smiling awkwardly, in the center of the room. "Turn around," said Mother. Her eyes were remote, looking at him. When he was gone, she never talked of him. She never said anything about anything but the weather or the condition of my neck and the need of a washcloth for it, or the fact that she didn't sleep nights. Once, she said the light was too strong at night. "But there's no moon this week," I said. "There's starlight," she said. I went to the store and bought her some darker, greener shades. As I lay in bed at night, I could hear her pull them down tight to the bottom of the windows. It made a long, rustling noise. Once, I tried to mow the lawn. "No," Mom stood in the door. "Put the mower away." So the grass went 3 months at a time without cutting. Dad cut it when he came home. She wouldn't let me do anything else either, like repairing the electrical breakfast maker or the mechanical book reader. She saved everything up, as if for Christmas. And then I would see Dad hammering or tinkering and always smiling at his work, and Mother smiling over him, happy. No, she never talked of him when he was gone. And as for Dad, he never did anything to make a contact across the millions of miles. He said once, "If I called you, I'd want to be with you. I wouldn't be happy." Once Dad said to me, "Your mother treats me, sometimes, as if I weren't here, as if I were invisible." I had seen her do it. She would look just beyond him, over his shoulder, at his chin or hands, but never into his eyes. If she did look at his eyes, her eyes were covered with a film, like an animal going to sleep. She said yes at the right times and smiled, but always a half second later than expected. "I'm not there for her," said Dad. But other days, she would be there, and he would be there for her, and they would hold hands and walk around the block, or take rides with Mom's hair flying like a girl's behind her. And she would cut off all the mechanical devices in the kitchen and bake him incredible cakes and pies and cookies, looking deep into his face, her smile a real smile. But at the end of such days when he was there to her, she would always cry, and Dad would stand helpless, gazing about the room as if to find the answer, but never finding it. Dad turned slowly in his uniform for us to see. "Turn around again," said Mom, and we'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to WSKV 104.9 Pickup Country, serving Powell, Estill, Montgomery, Clark, Lee, Bath, Menifee, Owsley, and Wolf counties.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com
with your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
Hey friends, this is Sarah Beth Terry, and this is how you stay healthy at work. Sick employees should follow CDC recommended steps. Employees should not return to work until they have met the criteria to discontinue home isolation and have consulted with a health care provider in state or local health departments. This message has been brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 FM.
The next morning, Dad came rushing into the house with handfuls of tickets. Pink rocket tickets for California. Blue tickets for Mexico. Come on, he said. We'll buy disposable clothes and burn them when they're soiled. Look, we can take the noon rocket to L.A., the 2 o'clock helicopter to Santa Barbara, the 9 o'clock plane to Ensenada, sleep overnight. And we went to California and up and down the Pacific coast for a day and a half, settling at last on the sands of Malibu to cook hot dogs at night. Dad was always listening, or singing, or watching things on all sides of him, holding on to things as if the world were a centrifuge going so swiftly that he might be flung off away from us at any instant. The last afternoon at Malibu, Mom was up in the hotel room. Dad lay on the sand beside me for a long time in the hot sun. Ah, he sighed. This is it. His eyes were gently closed. He lay on his back, drinking the sun. You miss this, he said. He meant on the rocket, of course, but he never said the rocket or mentioned the rocket and all the things you couldn't have on the rocket. He couldn't have a salt wind on the rocket or a blue sky or a yellow sun or Mom's cooking. You couldn't talk to your 14-year-old boy on a rocket. Let's hear it, he said at last. And I knew that now we would talk, as we had always talked, for 3 hours straight. All afternoon we would murmur back and forth in the lazy sun about my school grades, how high I could jump, how fast I could swim. Dad nodded each time I spoke, and smiled, and slapped my chest lightly in approval. We talked. We did not talk of rockets or space, but we talked of Mexico, where we had driven once in an ancient car, and of the butterflies we had caught in the rainforest of green, warm Mexico at noon, seeing the 100 butterflies sucked to our radiator, dying there, beating their blue and crimson wings, twitching, beautiful, and sad. We talked of such things instead of the things I wanted to talk about. And he listened to me. That was the thing he did, as if he was trying to fill himself up with all the sound he could hear. He listened to the wind and the falling ocean and my voice, always with a rapt attention, a concentration that almost excluded physical bodies themselves and kept only the sounds. He shut his eyes to listen. I would see him listening to the lawnmower as he cut the grass by hand, instead of using the remote control device. And I would see him smelling the cut grass as it sprayed up at him behind the mower in a green fount. Doug, he said, about 5 p.m, as we were picking up our towels and heading back along the beach near the surf. I want you to promise me something. What? Don't ever be a rocket man. I stopped. I mean it, he said. Because when you're out there, you want to be here. And when you're here, you want to be out there. Don't start that. Don't let it get hold of you. But you don't know what it is. Every time I'm out there, I think, if I ever get back to Earth, I'll stay there. I'll never go out again. But I go out, and I guess I'll always go out. I've thought about being a rocket man for a long time, I said. He didn't hear me. I try to stay here. Last Saturday when I got home, I started trying so hard to stay here. I remembered him in the garden, sweating, and all the traveling and doing and listening. And I knew that he did this to convince himself that the sea and the towns and the land and his family were the only real things and the good things. But I knew where he would be tonight, looking at the jewelry in Orion from our front porch. Promise me you won't be like me, he said. I hesitated a while. Okay, I said. He shook my hand. "Good boy," he said. The dinner was fine that night. Mom had run about the kitchen with handfuls of cinnamon and dough and pots and pans tinkling, and now a great turkey fumed on the table with dressing, cranberry sauce, peas, and pumpkin pie. "In the middle of August?" said Dad, amazed. "You won't be here for Thanksgiving." "So I won't." He sniffed it. He lifted each lid from each tureen and let the flavor steam over his sunburned face. He said, "Ah," to each. He looked at the room and his hands. He gazed at the pictures on the wall, the chairs, the table, me, and Mom. He cleared his throat. I saw him make up his mind. "Lily?" "Yes?" Mom looked across her table, which she had set like a wonderful silver trap, a miraculous gravy pit into which, like a struggling beast of the past, caught in a tar pool, her husband might at last be caught and held, gazing out through a jail of wishbones, safe forever. Her eyes sparkled. "Lily," said Dad. "Go on," I thought crazily. "Say it quick. Say you'll stay home this time, for good, and never go away. Say it." Just then, a passing helicopter jarred the room, and the window pane shook with a crystal sound. Dad glanced at the window. The blue stars of evening were there, and the red planet Mars was rising in the east. Dad looked at Mars a full minute. Then he put his hand out blindly toward me. "May I have some peas?" he said. "Excuse me," said Mother. "I'm going to get some bread." She rushed out into the kitchen. "But there's bread on the table," I said. Dad didn't look at me as he began his meal. I couldn't sleep that night. I came downstairs at 1 a.m, and the moonlight was like ice on all the housetops, and dew glittered in a snow field on our grass. I stood in the doorway in my pajamas, feeling the warm night wind, and then I knew that Dad was sitting in the mechanical porch swing, gliding gently. I could see his profile tilted back, and he was watching the stars wheel over the sky. His eyes were like gray crystal there, the moon in each one. I went out and sat beside him. We glided a while in the swing. At last I said, "How many ways are there to die in space?"
"A million."
"Name some."
"The meteors hit you. The air goes out of your rocket. Or comets take you along with them. Concussion, strangulation, explosion, centrifugal force, too much acceleration, too little. The heat, the cold, the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, the asteroids, the planetoids, radiation."
"And do they bury you?"
"They never find you."
"But where do you go?"
"A billion miles away. Traveling graves, they call them. You become a meteor or a planetoid traveling forever throughout space." I said nothing.
"One thing," he said later. "It's quick in space. Death. It's over like that. You don't linger. Most of the time, you don't even know it. You're dead, and that's it." We went up to bed. It was morning. Standing in the doorway, Dad listened to the yellow canary singing in its golden cage. "Well, I've decided," he said. "Next time I come home, I'm home to stay."
"Dad!"
I said. "Tell your mother that when she gets up," he said.
"You mean it?"
He nodded gravely. "See you in about 3 months. And there he went, off down the street, carrying his uniform in its secret box, whistling and looking at the tall green trees, and picking china berries off the china berry bush as he brushed by, tossing them ahead of him as he walked away into the bright shade of early morning. I asked Mother about a few things that morning after Father had been gone a number of hours.
"Dad said that I sometimes, you don't act as if you hear or see him," I said.
And then she explained everything to me quietly. "When he went off into space 10 years ago, I said to myself, he's dead, or as good as dead.
so think of him dead. And when he comes back, 3 or 4 times a year, it's not him at all. It's only a pleasant little memory or a dream. And if a memory stops or a dream stops, it can't hurt half as much. So most of the time, I think of him dead. But other times, I can't help myself. I bake pies and treat him as if he were alive. And then it hurts. No, it's better to think he hasn't been here for 10 years, and I'll never see him again. It doesn't hurt as much. Didn't he say next time he'd settle down? She shook her head slowly. No, he's dead. I'm very sure of that. He'll come alive again then, I said. 10 years ago, said Mother, I thought, what if he dies on Venus? Then we'll never be able to see Venus again. What if he dies on Mars? We'll never be able to look at Mars again, all red in the sky, without wanting to go in and lock the door. Or what if he died on Jupiter, or Saturn, or Neptune? On those nights when those planets were high in the sky, we wouldn't want to have anything to do with the stars. I guess not, I said. The message came the next day. The messenger gave it to me, and I read it standing on the porch. The sun was setting. Mom stood in the screen door behind me, watching me fold the message and put it in my pocket. Mom, I said. Don't tell me anything I don't already know, she said. She didn't cry. Well, it wasn't Mars, and it wasn't Venus, and it wasn't Jupiter or Saturn that killed him. We wouldn't have to think of him every time Jupiter or Saturn or Mars lit up the evening sky. This was different. His ship had fallen into the sun. And the sun was big and fiery and merciless, and it was always in the sky, and you couldn't get away from it. So, for a long time after my father died, my mother slept through the days and wouldn't go out. We had breakfast at midnight and lunch at 3 in the morning, and dinner at the cold, dim hour of 6 a.m. We went to all-night shows and went to bed at sunrise. And, for a long while, the only days we ever went out to walk were the days when it was raining and there was no sun. The end.
104.9 FM, WSKB.
This message is brought to you by the Powell County Public Library. All checkout dates have been extended until further notice, and there will be no late fees on any account at this time. As the library works toward its reopening date, you can expect our book drop service to return soon, as well as our new innovative curbside service. For more information about these services and the innovative programs we offer, keep an eye on the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page for any and all updates. Free Wi-Fi is still offered at the Powell County Public Library, which is located by Stanton Elementary. To access this Wi-Fi from the comfort of your vehicle, just select the network Public Library Wireless and use the free Wi-Fi password, PCPLKY65. Free Wi-Fi is also provided at the stationary bookmobile, which is in its new location at Clay City Elementary. To take advantage of the bookmobile Wi-Fi, just sign on to the network Bookmobile Wireless and use the same password from the main library, which is PCPLKY65. Flyers containing all of this information are posted on the doors of the main library and on the bookmobile for reference. Although the library isn't open to the public just yet, you can still check out our online catalog by going to the Powell County Public Library's website at pcplky.org to see everything our digital collection has to offer. And you can check out digital library books, audiobooks, and magazines with the free Libby or OverDrive apps in the Google Play or App Store. All you need is the barcode number on the back of your library card to have access to thousands of ebooks and digital materials. For any questions, just message the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page or send the library an email at info@pcplky.org. The staff of the Powell County Public Library encourages the community to continue practicing safe social distancing methods as our community opens back up so that we can all be a part of Team Kentucky.
Hey, this is Rachel Crow. The Kentucky Department of Health and Family Services say nursing homes and other long-term care providers are advised to restrict access to visitors and consult CDC guidelines for long-term care facilities. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
Now, I know what you might be thinking. At the end of last week's show, I promised I would find a story with a happy ending for you guys. Needless to say, I failed, and I apologize. However, it's my belief that the best stories don't necessarily have to end happily. Such is the case with our next story tonight, also by Ray Bradbury, titled Kaleidoscope. This is one of Bradbury's most famous short stories, and with good reason. It is equal parts haunting and sorrowful, and the imagery will stay with you even once the story is over. But I chose this story next because it is an interesting follow-up to our last story. In this story, we are thrust into a scene where a rocket has exploded in space, and the spacemen from the ship are all falling separately to their inevitable doom. Sound familiar? It's easy to imagine that this story is what happened to the boy's father from the previous story. This is Kaleidoscope by Ray Bradbury. The first concussion cut the rocket up the side with a giant can opener. The men were thrown into space like a dozen wriggling silver fish. They were scattered into a dark sea, and the ship, in a million pieces, went on, a meteor swarm seeking a lost son. "Barkley! Barkley! Where are you?" The sound of voices calling like lost children on a cold night. "Wood! Wood! Captain! Hollis! Hollis! This is Stone! Stone, this is Hollis. Where are you?" "I don't know. How can I? Which way is up? I'm falling. Good God, I'm falling!" They fell. They fell as pebbles fall down wells. They were scattered as jackstones are scattered from a gigantic throw. And now, instead of men, there were only voices. All kinds of voices, disembodied and impassioned, in varying degrees of terror and resignation. "We're going away from each other!" This was true. Hollis, swinging head over heels, knew this was true. He knew it with a vague acceptance. They were parting to go their separate ways, and nothing could bring them back. They were wearing their sealed tight spacesuits with the glass tubes over their pale faces, but they hadn't had time to lock on their force units. With them, they could be small lifeboats in space, saving themselves, saving others, collecting together, finding each other until they were an island of men with some plan. But without the force units snapped to their shoulders, they were meteors, senseless, each going to a separate and irrevocable fate. A period of perhaps 10 minutes elapsed while the first terror died, and a metallic calm took its place. Space began to weave its strange voices in and out on a great dark loom, crossing, recrossing, making a final pattern. "Stone to Hollis, how long can we talk by phone?" "It depends on how fast you're going your way, and I'm going mine." "An hour, I make it." "That should do it," said Hollis, abstracted and quiet. "What happened?" said Hollis, a minute later. "The rocket blew up, that's all. Rockets do blow up." "Which way are you going?" "It looks like I'll hit the moon." "It's Earth for me, back to old Mother Earth at 10,000 miles per hour. I'll burn like a match." Hollis thought of it with a queer abstraction of mind. He seemed to be removed from his body, watching it fall down and down through space, as objective as he had been in regard to the first falling snowflakes of a winter season long gone. The others were silent, thinking of the destiny that had brought them to this, falling, falling, and nothing they could do to change it. Even the captain was quiet, for there was no command or plan he knew that could put things back together again. "Oh, it's a long way down. Oh, it's a long way down. A long, long, long way down," said a voice. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. It's a long way down. Who's that?
I don't know.
Stimson, I think. Stimson, is that you?
It's a long, long way, and I don't like it. Oh, God, I don't like it.
Stimson, this is Hollis. Stimson, you hear me? A pause while they fell separate from one another.
Stimson.
Yes? He replied at last.
Stimson, take it easy. We're all in the same fix.
I don't want to be here. I want to be somewhere else.
There's a chance we'll be found.
I must be, said Stimson. I don't believe this. I don't believe any of this is happening.
It's a bad dream, said someone.
Shut up, said Hollis.
Come and make me, said the voice. It was Applegate. He laughed easily, with a similar objectivity. Come and shut me up.
Hollis, for the first time, felt the impossibility of his position. A great anger filled him, for he wanted more than anything at this moment to be able to do something to Applegate. He had wanted for many years to do something, and now it was too late. Applegate was only a telephonic voice. Falling, falling, falling. Now, as if they had discovered the horror, two of the men began to scream. In a nightmare, Hollis saw one of them float by, very near, screaming and screaming.
Stop it!
The man was almost at his fingertips, screaming insanely. He would never stop. He would go on screaming for a million miles, as long as he was in radio range, disturbing all of them, making it impossible for them to talk to one another. Hollis reached out. It was best this way. He made the extra effort and touched the man. He grasped the man's ankle and pulled himself up along the body until he reached the head. The man screamed and clawed frantically like a drowning swimmer. The screaming filled the universe. One way or the other, thought Hollis. The moon or earth or meteors will kill him, so why not now? He smashed the man's glass mask with his iron fist. The screaming stopped. He pushed off from the body and let it spin away on its own course, falling. Falling, falling down space, Hollis and the rest of them went in the long, endless dropping and whirling of silence.
Hollis, you still there?
Hollis did not speak, but felt the rush of heat in his face. This is Applegate again.
All right, Applegate.
Let's talk. We haven't anything else to do. The captain cut in. That's enough of that. We've got to figure a way out of this.
Captain, why don't you shut up? Said Applegate.
What? You heard me, Captain. Don't pull your rank on me. You're 10,000 miles away by now. And let's not kid ourselves. As Stimson puts it, it's a long way down.
See here, Applegate. Can it? This is a mutiny of one. I haven't a darn thing to say to lose. Your ship was a bad ship, and you were a bad captain, and I hope you break when you hit the moon.
I'm ordering you to stop.
Go on, order me again.
Applegate smiled across 10,000 miles. The captain was silent. Applegate continued. Where were we, Hollis? Oh yes, I remember. I hate you too. But you know that. You've known it for a long time.
Hollis clenched his fists, helplessly.
I want to tell you something, said Applegate. Make you happy. I was the one who blackballed you with the rocket company 5 years ago.
A meteor flashed by. Hollis looked down, and his left hand was gone. Blood spurted. Suddenly, there was no air in his suit. He had enough air in his lungs to move his right hand over and twist a knob at his left elbow, tightening the joint and sealing the leak. It had happened so quickly that he was not surprised. Nothing surprised him anymore. The air in the suit came back to normal in an instant now that the leak was sealed. And the blood that had flowed so swiftly was pressured as he fastened the knob yet tighter, until it made a tourniquet. All of this took place in a terrible silence on his part. And the other men chatted. That one man, Laspierre, went on and on with his talk about his wife on Mars, his wife on Venus, his wife on Jupiter, his money, his wondrous times, his drunkenness, his gambling, his happiness. On and on while they all fell. Laspierre reminisced on the past, happy while he fell to his death. It was so very odd. Space. Thousands of miles of space. And these voices, vibrating in the center of it. No one visible at all, and only the radio waves quivering and trying to quicken other men into emotion. Are you angry, Hollis? No. And he was not. The abstraction had returned, and he was a thing of dull concrete, forever falling nowhere. You wanted to get to the top all your life, Hollis. You always wondered what happened. I put the black mark on you just before I was tossed out myself. That isn't important, said Hollis. And it was not. It was gone. When life is over, it is like a flicker of bright film, an instant on the screen, all of his prejudices and passions condensed and illumined for an instant on space. And before you could cry out, there was a happy day, there a bad one, there an evil face, there a good one. The film burned to a cinder. The screen went dark. From this outer edge of his life, looking back, there was only one remorse, and that was only that he wished to go on living. Did all dying people feel this way, as if they had never lived? Did life seem that short, indeed, over and done before you took a breath? Did it seem that this abrupt and impossible to everyone, or only to himself, here, now, with a few hours left to him for thought and deliberation. And we'll be back with more right after this.
Eastern Kentucky's Country, WSKV 104.9 FM.
And on the web
at WSKVFM.com.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com.
With your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
Hey, this is Hannah Wheeler. You can help stop the spread of germs by practicing social distancing, staying about 6 feet from others, especially those who are sick. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
Broadcasting 24/7 from the Stanton Urban Studios, Appalachian Proud, Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV FM.
This message is brought to you by the Powell County Public Library. All checkout dates have been extended until further notice, and there will be no late fees on any account at this time. As the library works towards its reopening date, you can expect our book drop service to return soon, as well as our new innovative curbside service. For more information about these services and the innovative programs we offer, keep an eye on the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page for any and all updates. Free Wi-Fi is still offered at the Powell County Public Library, which is located by Stanton Elementary. To access this Wi-Fi from the comfort of your vehicle, just select the network Public Library Wireless and use the free Wi-Fi password PCPLKY65. Free Wi-Fi is also provided at the stationary bookmobile, which is in its new location at the Clay City Elementary. To take advantage of the bookmobile Wi-Fi, just sign on to the network Bookmobile Wireless and use the same password for the main library, which is PCPLKY65. Flyers containing all of this information are posted on the doors of the main library and on the bookmobile for reference. Although the library isn't open to the public yet, you can still check out our online catalog by going to the Powell County Public Library's website at pcplky.org to see everything our digital collection has to offer. And you can check out digital library books, audiobooks, and magazines with the free Libby or OverDrive apps in the Google Play or App Store. All you need is the barcode number on the back of your library card to have access to thousands of ebooks and digital materials. For any questions, just message the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page or send the library an email at info@pcplky.org. The staff of the Powell County Public Library encourages the community to continue practicing safe and social distancing methods as our community opens back up so that we can all be a part of Team Kentucky.
Hey, this is Anna Klein.
And John Lenny.
We're Grits and Soul. You can help stop the spread of the COVID-19 virus. Please avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth.
If you wear a mask, bandana, or scarf to cover your face, be sure to cover your nose and mouth.
Be cautious about touching your face while adjusting it throughout the day, and wash your hands regularly or wear gloves to prevent further spreading of germs. Stay well. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
One of the other men, LaSpear, was talking. Well, I had me a good time. I had a wife on Mars, Venus, and Jupiter. Each of them had money and treated me swell. I got drunk, and once I gambled away $20,000. But you're here now, thought Hollis. I didn't have any of those things. When I was living, I was jealous of you, LaSpear. When I had another day ahead of me, I envied you, your women, and your good times. Women frightened me, and I went into space, always wanting them and jealous of you for having them, and money, and as much happiness as you could have in your own wild way. But now, falling here, with everything over, I'm not jealous of you anymore, because it's over for you as it is for me, and right now, it's like it never was. Hollis craned his face forward and shouted into the telephone, "It's all over, LaSpear!" Silence. "It's just as if it never was, LaSpear!" "Who's that?" LaSpear's faltering voice. "This is Hollis." He was being mean. He felt the meanness, the senseless meanness of dying. Applegate had hurt him. Now he wanted to hurt another. Applegate and space had both wounded him. "You're out here, LaSpear. It's all over. It's just as if it had never happened, isn't it?" "No. When anything's over, it's just like it never happened. Where is your life any better than mine now? Now is what counts. Is it any better? Is it?" "Yes, it's better." "How?" "Because I got my thoughts. I remember," cried LaSpear, far away, indignant, holding his memories to his chest with both hands. And he was right. With a feeling of cold water rushing through his head and body, Hollis knew he was right. There were differences between memories and dreams. He had only dreams of things he had wanted to do, while LaSpear had memories of things done and accomplished. And this knowledge began to pull Hollis apart with a slow, quivering precision. "What good does it do you?" he cried to LaSpear. "Now? When a thing's over, it's not good anymore. You're no better off than I." "I'm resting easy," said LaSpear. "I've had my turn. I'm not getting mean at the end, like you." "Mean?" Hollis turned the word on his tongue. He had never been mean, as long as he could remember, in his life. He had never dared to be mean. He must have saved it all of these years for such a time as this. "Mean?" He rolled the word into the back of his mind. He felt tears start into his eyes and roll down his face. Someone must have heard his gasping voice. "Gee, take it easy, Hollis." It was, of course, ridiculous. Only a minute before, he had been giving advice to others, to Stimson. He had felt a braveness which he had thought to be the genuine thing, and now he knew that it had been nothing but shock and the objectivity possible in shock. Now he was trying to pack a lifetime of suppressed emotion into an interval of minutes. "I know how you feel, Hollis," said LaSpear, now 20,000 miles away, his voice fading. "I don't take it personally." "But aren't we equal?" he wondered. "LaSpear and I? Here? Now? If a thing's over, it's done, and what good is it? You die anyway." But he knew he was rationalizing, for it was like trying to tell the difference between a live man and a corpse. There was a spark in one, and not in the other, an aura, a mysterious element. So it was with LaSpear and himself. LaSpear had lived a good full life, and it made him a different man now, and he, Hollis, had been as good as dead for many years. They came to death by separate paths, and, in all likelihood, if there were kinds of death, their kinds would be as different as night from day. The quality of death, like that of life, must be of an infinite variety, and if one has already died once, then what was there to look for in dying for good and all, as he was now? It was a second later that he discovered his right foot was cut sheer away. It almost made him laugh. The air was gone from his suit again. He bent quickly, and there was blood, and the meteor had taken flesh and suit away to the ankle. Oh, death in space was most humorous. It cut you away, piece by piece, like a black and invisible butcher. He tightened the valve at the knee, his head whirling into pain, fighting to remain aware, and with the valve tightened, the blood retained, the air kept, he straightened up and went on falling, falling, for that was all there was left to do. Hollis? Hollis nodded sleepily, tired of waiting for death. "This is Applegate again," said the voice. "Yes." "I've had time to think. I listened to you. This isn't good. It makes us bad. This is a bad way to die. It brings all the bile out. You listening, Hollis?" "Yes." "I lied a minute ago. I lied. I didn't blackball you. I don't know why I said that. Guess I wanted to hurt you. You seemed the one to hurt. We've always fought. Guess I'm getting old fast and repenting fast. I guess listening to you be mean made me ashamed. Whatever the reason, I want you to know I was an idiot too. There's not an ounce of truth in what I said. To heck with you." Hollis felt his heart begin to work again. It seemed as if it hadn't worked for 5 minutes, but now all of his limbs began to take color and warmth. The shock was over, and the successive shocks of anger and terror and loneliness were passing. He felt like a man emerging from a cold shower in the morning, ready for breakfast and a new day. "Thanks, Applegate." "Don't mention it. Up your nose." "Hey," said Stone. "What?" Hollis called across space, for Stone, of all of them, was a good friend. "I've got myself into a meteor swarm, some little asteroids." "Meteors?" "I think it's the Mirabidon cluster that goes out past Mars and in toward Earth once every 5 years. I'm right in the middle. It's like a big kaleidoscope. You get all kinds of colors and shapes and sizes. God, it's beautiful, all that metal." Silence. "I'm going with them," said Stone. "They're taking me off with them. I'll be..." He laughed. Hollis looked to see, but saw nothing. There were only the great diamonds and sapphires and emerald mists and velvet inks of space, with God's voice mingling among the crystal fires. There was a kind of wonder and imagination in the thought of Stone going off in the meteor swarm, out past Mars for years and coming in toward Earth every 5 years, passing in and out of the planet's ken for the next million centuries. Stone and the Myrmidon cluster, eternal and unending, shifting and shaping like the kaleidoscope colors when you were a child and held the long tube to the sun and gave it a twirl. "So long, Hollis," Stone's voice, very faint now. "So long." "Good luck," shouted Hollis across 30,000 miles. "Aw, don't be funny," said Stone, and was gone. The stars closed in. Now all the voices were fading, each on his own trajectory, some to Mars, others into farthest space, and Hollis himself? He looked down. He, of all the others, was going back to Earth, alone. "So long. Take it easy." "So long, Hollis." That was Applegate. The many goodbyes, the short farewells. And now the great loose brain was disintegrating. The components of the brain which had worked so beautifully and efficiently in the skull case of the rocket ship, firing through space, were dying, one by one. The meaning of their life together was falling apart. And as a body dies when the brain ceases functioning, so the spirit of the ship and their long time together and what they meant to one another was dying. Applegate was now no more than a finger blown from the parent body, no longer to be despised and worked against. The brain was exploded, and the senseless, useless fragments of it were far scattered. The voices faded, and now all of space was silent. Hollis was alone, falling. They were all alone. Their voices had died like echoes of the words of God, spoken and vibrating in the star deep. There went the captain to the moon. There's Stone with the meteor swarm. There's Stimson. There's Applegate toward Pluto. There's Smith and Turner and Underwood and all the rest. The shreds of the kaleidoscope that had formed a thinking pattern for so long hurled apart. And I? Thought Hollis. What can I do? Is there anything I could do now to make up for a terrible and empty life? If only I could do one good thing to make up for the meanness I collected all these years and didn't even know was in me. But there's no one here but myself. And how can you do good all alone? You can't. Tomorrow night, I'll hit Earth's atmosphere. I'll burn, he thought, and be scattered in ashes all over the continental lands. I'll be put to use, just a little bit. But ashes are ashes, and they'll add to the land. He fell swiftly, like a bullet, like a pebble, like an iron weight, objective, objective all of the time now. Not sad, or happy, or anything, but only wishing he could do a good thing now that everything was gone. A good thing for just himself to know about. When I hit the atmosphere, I'll burn like a meteor. I wonder, he said, if anyone will see me. The small boy on the country road looked up and screamed, "Look, Mom, look, a falling star!" The blazing white star fell down the sky of dusk in Illinois. "Make a wish," said his mother. "Make a wish." The end. Thank you so much for joining us tonight for our Pick Me a Story series, right here on your hometown station, Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV. If you missed tonight's segment, you can always listen on demand at listenlikealocal.com with your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store and on Apple Podcast. If you enjoyed tonight's show, be sure to tune in next Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and join me for the next installment of Pick Me a Story. My name is Kelly Ward and I'm the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library, and it's my pleasure to share stories with the community during this time when we should all be staying healthy at home and practicing social distancing methods. If you have any recommendations for what books we should explore next, just send me an email at kward@pcplky.org. That's kward@pcplky.org. Don't forget to tune in next week on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, online at listenlikealocal.com, or with the free WSKV app for our next installment of Pick Me a Story. Be safe and have a wonderful rest of your evening.